right, all right, all right.
Those were the first words that actor Matthew McConaughey ever uttered on screen for the 1993 film Dazed and Confused, and they've become something of a calling card for McConaughey's career, which includes hit romantic comedies like The Wedding Planner and his Oscar-winning performance in Dallas Buyers Club. Now, Matthew McConaughey has added author to his resume. He took years of his diaries and turned them into a book that's part memoir, part guide to living. It's called Green Lights, and he joins me now on Skype. Matthew, thanks for speaking with us. Welcome to Here and Now.
Hey, good to be here.
Yeah, and you know, we're in such a moment right now. We're locked down in a pandemic, reeling from racial violence. We're on the cusp of a bitter election. Why should people read a book by Matthew McConaughey right now?
Yeah, well, you read Green Lights? It's a good news book about how to deal with the yellow and red lights in our lives, a la many of which you just spoke of. And how to not foolishly, but still find green light assets in the red and yellow light times. You know, green lights are, we love those. They're like a shoeless summer.
Well, let's talk about that. Like, what is a green light?
So a green light is an affirmation, setting yourself up for success. A green light can be as simple as putting your coffee in the coffee filter before you go to bed. So tomorrow morning, all you got to do is push the button. You are teeing yourself up for ease and success and more of yourself in the future. We make those by decisions we make. Sometimes they just fall in our lap.
Well, and you talk about these green light moments throughout the course of your life. Let's talk a little bit about your early days. You grew up, from what I can tell in this book, in a pretty tough family. The way that you write about it feels violent, but also at the same time, full of love. How could that be?
Well, thank you. I'm glad you got that. Because on paper, if you wrote just the facts of some of these things that happened in my childhood, you would call Child Protection Services. You would be like, get the cops over here. This is abuse. But it wasn't.
It wasn't. I mean, I think at one point, one of your brothers hit your dad with a 2x4 in a fight.
Yeah. And after that, they ended up hugging each other and crying it out and became best of friends. Now, I tell the stories of discipline and consequence as love stories in this book because they were the moments where the cocoon of love that we all knew our family had, when that was tested the most. Yet the love never had a chance of losing.
Well, I'll be honest, though. I kind of felt like sometimes you might have been holding back on us a little bit. You wrote extensively about your childhood and some of the conflicts that you had. You wrote a whole chapter about your a year abroad in doing the Rotary in Australia. But then when your father dies, I believe it was in the early 1990s, you spend just a few paragraphs on it. Do you feel like you fully grappled with it?
That's a good question. I did spend time and still do actively spend time dealing with the loss of my father. I rushed back home. We had our late nights and lots of tears for 4 or 5 days with the immediate family. Then we had the Irish wake for him. Then it was about getting back to work. And my family said, this is what your dad would want you to do. It was never out of sight, out of mind. I dealt and learned with my father's passing heavily for the next 3 years after his death. And still do integrate and have him as a part of my life, although only spiritually now, this many years later.
Well, let me ask you about another moment in the book that passed very quickly. In the opening chapter, you take one line to reveal that when you were 18 years old, you were knocked out and molested by a man in the backseat of a van. Is that something that you talk about?
No, I've never shared that. That was new to my mom, my family, to all of my best friends. Yeah, you know, I don't know what I could share in the book that could be constructive about that. All the other stories I tell, there's a constructive way I either learned to deal with it at the time or later on. In this particular instance you're talking about, I don't know what the lesson was to be learned. It was clearly wrong. It was not debatable. And so that clarity, I think, allowed me to compartmentalize that, put that away and go, that was a moment in time. This is not going to define you. You're not going to be heady about this. You're not going to be hung up on this. It was an ugly situation that I've put in the rearview mirror.
Well, look, people are going to want to hear about your personal stories, but also your acting life. And it sounds like acting was pretty far from your mind growing up. You originally wanted to be a lawyer. You then changed your mind. I think in your late teens, maybe early 20s, you switched to film school. And soon after that, you get this just a huge break playing a guy in his 20s named Wooderson, who still hangs out with high school kids. Let's listen to this clip from Dazed and Confused in 1993.
That's what I love about these high school girls, man. I get older, they stay the same age.
There's the same laugh right there. That line pretty much launched your career. And I don't think people realize you had like no acting experience at that point, basically.
No, I didn't have any. I went up to the producer of the film, the casting director of the film, in a bar one night. He later on said, "You ever done any acting?" I said, "No." He goes, "Well, you might be right for this part. Come down, try it out." I pick up the script. That line in that scene was one of the lines. And you just said an apropos word, launched. That line is what I call a launch pad line. I try to find a launch pad line with every character. But that line, no, that's what I love about those high school girls. I get older, but they stay the same age. I'm like, well, if this person believes that and is not trying to be cool, not trying to play an attitude, well, there's a very thick encyclopedia on this guy. A line like that opened up my eyes into like to the whole character of who Wooderson was to me.
But you weren't famous yet, right? I mean, it launched your career, but it wasn't until 1996 with A Time to Kill, the courtroom drama.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's when you start realizing that you walk down the street and people know who you are. How did you handle becoming famous?
I think I handled it pretty well. I think I enjoyed it, but there was definitely an imbalance to it. I really had to question at that time, well, what really matters? I took a walkabout to a monastery for a while. I took another walkabout to Peru on my own. All these solo trips to go let my own identity catch up, where I could see through what was real at this time, where my feet were not feeling so firmly on the ground.
Because you had become rom-com McConaughey, right?
That was much later. No, 96 after Time to Kill was just pure straight fame. The rom-com stuff came more years later. And at the same time, I was rom-com McConaughey. I was shirtless on the beach McConaughey. All things of which I will always look you square in the eye and go, you damn right, that was me. And those rom-coms paid the rent for those houses on the beach, which is where I was shirtless. Fact. Guilty. At that time, though, I could receive a rom-com script tonight and feel like I could do it tomorrow morning. And there was nothing wrong with that. But I was like, my work's really not challenging me like my life is challenging me, mind you. Camille and I just had our first child. Boy, an incredibly vital time. So I remember saying, if my life's more vital than my work, that's good. But can my work challenge the vitality of the life I'm living? And I wasn't getting that from the rom-coms. The work I wanted to do to challenge my life's vitality was not being offered to McConaughey. Nobody wanted to make those dramas I wanted to make. So I decided if I can't do what I want to do, I'm going to stop doing what I've been doing. 20 months go by of no work. You have not seen me on any beach sans shirt. You have not seen me in your living room or theater in a rom-com. Where the hell's McConaughey? What happened was after 20 months of being forgotten, I became a new good idea. Lincoln Lawyer, Killer Joe, Magic Mike, Mud, True Detective, Dallas Buyers Club, The Paperboy. It was the Where's McConaughey? And in the Where's McConaughey came the novel idea of, you know who'd be a good idea for this? McConaughey.
Well, and as you say, I mean, it paid off. Dallas Buyers Club, a beautiful biographical film about a man named Ron Woodruff, who learns that he has AIDS in the 1980s, and then he tries to find alternative treatments that aren't available to people. And here you are in a scene with Jennifer Garner, who plays your doctor.
Germany, they got this dextran sulfate. All right, and they got this DDC in France, supposed to keep the healthy cells you got from getting the HIV. And they got AL721 over in Israel. How can I get some of this?
None of those drugs have been approved by the FDA.
Look, screw the FDA. I'm going to be DOA. I got to sue the hospital to get my medicine.
You won an Oscar for that film, of course, Best Actor. What does it mean to you this many years after it?
You know, that that was a very pinnacle moment in my journey of my career. It meant that for me, that as an actor, that as an artist, my product I was putting out, the essence of myself through my characters I was putting out, it was translating. I love that word, translate. What I intended to do is what pretty closely was done. There was not a gap. A lot of times in performances, you know, what we want to do and what we're actually doing and what gets recorded and what you see, there can be a large gap between the four of those. This was a time where I felt like, no, what I intended to do didn't have a large gap as you received it.
Do you think that everybody gets as many green lights as a guy like Matthew McConaughey?
Maybe not. Maybe not. And look, green lights are relative. You know, what kind of green lights am I looking for? we also have to watch that there are certain green lights, and I write about them in the book, that were, you know, battery powered. They're not going to last. They're stops, not stays. I'm looking for the solar powered eternal green lights. That's what I'm chasing. I don't think I'm going to catch all of them, but I don't think that's even what it's about. It's just about chasing them. I think we are our own aspiration, and we should interrogate and investigate ourselves, get to know ourselves as well as possible. And in doing so, we will learn and we find out what our own green lights are. Major green light, think about our eulogy. Just jump up to the objective eye of after we're gone and say, what story is going to be told? And what story is going to introduce me for the rest of time? In that answer, I've found that I feel more like living and living true and hard than I did before asking that question. And I think most people will as well.
Matthew McConaughey, the new memoir is Green Lights. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Pleasure to speak with you. See you the next time.